Tonight we're going to continue in our study of 1 Kings, if you'd turn to chapter 9. Chapter 9. We left off last week with the Festival of Praise and Worship to commemorate the temple being built. It said there in the last verse of chapter 8 that they were all to go to their tents, and they went to their tents joyful of heart for all the goodness of God. And I like that statement. I like to be filled with the Spirit. I like to walk in the Spirit. I have no better time in my entire week than right after Sunday service to come home and be full of the Spirit, knowing that I have ministered with godly people, and the Spirit has been in our congregation. I just find it as a great afternoon, especially when football season's on. But I tell you, there's nothing like being around the saints, His saints, and His kingdom. And we see here that that's what exactly was taking place in chapter 8. And Israel was at the height of their glory. Now, they were stepping into an age that there has never been an age since for the nation Israel. We're going to look at some of the really gaudy money that they had and gold and all these different things. And it's pretty amazing at the height that they ascend to in these two chapters. But at the same time, they are preparing for a fall. And I want you to keep that in the back of your mind as we study these two chapters. It will be applicable to us tonight. We will see in chapter 9 God reminding Solomon that he and the people must remain committed to Him. No matter how materially you are blessed, you must remain committed to Him. And in chapter 10, we will see the problem of material wealth come into Solomon's life. And it is a danger for every one of us. You don't have to be rich to fall into it. Materials can get a hold of your heart. So let's get started there in chapter 9, verse 1 and 2. And it came to pass when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all of Solomon's desires which he wanted to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon the second time. And he had appeared to him at Gibeon. Here's something that is reality. It has been 20 years since the first time that Solomon had spoken to God. In our studies here, we think it's just, well, just a couple pages back. But it was 20 years since this time took place. There can be long periods of time between the Lord's dealing with you and me. I sometimes get caught up in not hearing from the Lord for a while, thinking I have to have a revelation from Him every so often. But it really just isn't that way. In James chapter 2, verse 23, it says, "And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God." Yet there was large spaces of time that Abraham did not hear from God at all. He didn't have a Bible. He didn't have a church. There was no such thing then. You read the book of Acts, for instance. The book of Acts is exciting. We studied it as a church group here. And, you know, it seems like there was things going on just day after day, miraculous things taking place. But yet, do you realize that in the book of Acts, there was a period of 38 years that book covered? Listen to me carefully here. God is interested in developing you and me for eternity. And so He wants us to walk by faith and not by sight. We want to walk by sight. We want to see God in everything. We want to go to church and be touched of the Lord. We want the pastor to just rev us up with the great message. We want the worship to be red hot and just the Spirit moving. But does it always happen that way? No. Because God wants to see a discipline developed in your life to praise Him when we might not feel His presence. To study His Word, even when you might not experience that fresh revelation. When you open that Bible and you are reading and you say, man, I just read two chapters and I don't remember a word of what I just read. Those are the times, my friends, that God is honing you. He is developing that strength of character and perseverance and discipline that will take you on to maturity. And the Lord said to him, verse 3, I have heard your prayer and your supplication that you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built to put my name there forever. And my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. Now, if you walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded you, and if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. Let's stop there. You know, the first thing here is that God acknowledges their hearts in what they have already done. He's acknowledging their hearts at being righteous. Remember, God knows the motives behind what you do because He knows your heart. It doesn't do any good to go to church and teach Sunday school or be a volunteer for this or that soup ministry or a part of the worship team if your heart is in the wrong place. God said, if you will walk before me, transparent before me as David walked, you say, what, you mean lie, cheat, manipulate, commit adultery? David did that. I can walk in the flesh, you're saying, Larry? Well, I would say to that yes with this explanation. David had a heart for God like no other man. He had a heart for God and he loved God. Oh, he got caught up in the flesh, no doubt. I don't want to discount that at all. And he did horrible things that caused him to suffer the consequences for the rest of his life after he did them. But listen, in 1 Samuel chapter 16, 7, it says, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not look as, does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. I can't ever say that enough. God looks at your heart. He doesn't look at your performance. He doesn't look at how good-looking you are. He doesn't look at how smart you are. He looks at your heart, your emotion towards Him, and your motives. If your heart is right towards God, you have a great thing going. David had a great thing going because he had a heart that was steadfast on God. I may fail, I may falter, but if my heart is steadfast unto God, He takes notice. My best example I can give to you of this very important principle is in my garden. If you were a tomato plant of mine, if you were weak and diseased in my garden, I wouldn't pull you up. You see, I nurture every single plant I plant. I take great joy in seeing a weak plant that for whatever reason, and I'm no botanist, that plant comes up and it's just scraggly. It's weak and ugly and it hasn't filled its space in. It's got a vine going this way and a vine going that way and about three or four leaves. And I look at that thing and I say, boy, you need a lot of work. But I take great pleasure to pull a full ripe tomato, even though I may get only two or three from that plant. I take great pleasure in seeing that thing to maturity. And I submit to you that God does too in you. He is molding and shaping, and I don't care how flawed you are, I don't care how faltered you are, if you have a heart for God, as my tomato plant has a heart for me, as the master grower, then God takes heed. Verse 6, but if you or your sons, now here's the alternate side, at all turn from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them. And this house which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all people. And as for this house which is exalted, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and will hiss and say, why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house? Then they will answer, because they forsook the Lord their God who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and have embraced other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore the Lord has brought all this calamity on them. You see, this is why I said what I did earlier about your heart in the heart of your nation, my nation. If we follow after other gods, little g, then God will take account of that because He's a jealous God. If you deny Him, that's one thing. That's a serious thing. But if you turn from Him and you bow your heart to Buddha or some statue, that God will act upon that. I guarantee you. He will not allow you to bow to another God. Why? Because He's a jealous God. That's why I've been alarmed at America as we began that separation of church and state in the early 60s. That was bad enough. Separating and saying, you know, that God shouldn't be a part of government or law or that sort of thing, or even our schools. That's bad enough. But I could take that. But when they start legislating other religions that you have to include, my friends, the God I know of the Bible will not allow that. He'll not allow that. And there will be a wrath of God's guaranteed. Now it happened in verse 10, at the end of 20 years, when Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house. Hiram, the king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress and gold, as much as he desired. That King Solomon then gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. Then Hiram went from Tyre to see the cities which Solomon had given him, but they did not please him. So he said, what kind of cities are these which you have given me, my brother? And he called them the land of Kabul, as they are to this day. Then Hiram sent the king 120 talents of gold. Let's stop there. We need to understand what's happening here. Solomon had lots of gold, lots and lots of gold, But all of that gold that he was given by David and how he had arranged and collected all this, that was dedicated to the temple. And it could only be used for the temple. Now remember, we were watching Solomon at the end of the previous chapter. He was building other buildings. There were government buildings. There was the Forest of Lebanon and some of these other places. So he borrowed gold and silver from Hiram, King Hiram, another nation, his friend, to use on these buildings. And he said to his friend, I'll give you these 10 cities close to your border there for payment. So Hiram decided to go and check out those 10 cities close to his border. He toured them, and he says, man, those are dirty little cities. That's what that word means there, Kabul. Dirty. Dirty little cities. And he wasn't impressed. So Solomon wanted him to remain his friend. So he sends him 4.5 tons of gold, which is what he had supplied to Solomon. Exactly. He repaid him exactly what he had borrowed, plus 10 cities. So why is this in our chapters? I pondered that a little while, and I come up with a couple of principles that apply. One, we should, as Christians, I believe it is a green light, or at least an okay, to the area of borrowing. There's been many controversial things brought up about borrowing amongst Christians, amongst the world. And in this case here, nothing was ever said against Solomon for having borrowed money, gold in this case. But there are some specific things that is in the New Testament. That is, brother to brother, we shouldn't charge each other interest. Okay? But it is okay to borrow. Some people really get worked up about the, well, you shouldn't borrow to buy your house or whatever. I think that there's clear principles to be aware of that you're not to get in a situation where you cannot pay it back. You are to repay that you give your promise. We should always err on the side of conservative as Christians. And so, therefore, when you have a conflict with a brother, as they had here, this guy wasn't a Christian. This guy, King Hiram from Tyre, was a Gentile. But they were friends from David on. And he wanted to make it right. So he gives him 4.5 tons or whatever it was, tons of gold, and those 10 cities to make him happy. And apparently that did make him happy. So in your conflicts with people, I think that we should go out on the very loving side and give generously to keep friends. People will say, well, you know, that's his problem. Turn around and walk away. If Solomon had done that, he'd have had war with Hiram. There would have been a neighbor upset. So he treated him fairly and gave him back what he borrowed plus the 10 cities. Let's move on. Verse 15, and this is the reason for the labor force which King Solomon raised to build the house of the Lord, his own house, the Milo, the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and taken Gezer and burned it with fire, had killed the Canaanites who dwelt in the city, and had given it as a dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. And Solomon built Gezer, Lower Beth Horon, Baaleth, and Tadmor in the wilderness and in the land of Judah. All the storage cities that Solomon had, cities for his chariots and cities for his cavalry, and whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. You know, this section here describes a lot of what King Solomon did, and there is nothing that was said that was good or bad. It what kings do. It reminds me of a story I read about two little boys. Two little boys that were driving their little toy dump trucks out in the backyard of their house in their sand pit. And a conversation was brought up later by one of the little boys' mother. And she said to him, he says, "Well, what did you and your friend do out there?" "Oh, we were honey dipping." And she gasped and she says, "Son, you shouldn't be talking that way." Why did she say that? Well, you see, in 1950, which was the era these boys were living in, many of the houses still had outdoor plumbing, if you know what I mean. Outhouses. One of the boys' dad was a honey dipper, in that he would dig out the pits under the outhouse and put the substance in the great big old tank in the back of his truck, and he'd dump it in the city dump. It was a worthy way of making a living. He did it by the sweat of his brow, but it wasn't something that society looked upon as a very good occupation. And so with that story, I say, honey dippers do what honey dippers do. And kings do what kings do. All the people who were left to Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites in verse 20, who were not of the children of Israel, that is, their descendants, who were left in the land after them, whom the children of Israel had not been able to destroy completely, from these Solomon raised forced labor, and it is to this day. But of the children of Israel, Solomon made no forced laborers, because they were men of war, and his servants, his officers, his captains, commanders of his chariots and his cavalry. All were chiefs of the officers who were over Solomon's work, 550 who ruled over the people who did the work. You know, the slaves or the people that David had conquered were used to protect the outlying cities and the border towns where the enemy was prone to attack. He would find the weaker areas to infiltrate the country. And so David had made these guys slaves, and Solomon was using them to protect the borders. But he didn't ever use any Jew. That's what's being brought out here. The Jews were not to be used as slaves. But Pharaoh's daughter in verse 24 came up from the city of David to her house, which Solomon had built for her. Then he built the Milo. Now, three times a year, Solomon offered burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar which he had built for the Lord. And he burned incense with them on the altar that was before the Lord. So he finished the temple. It says there are three feasts. Now, those feasts were Passover, Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles. To us, these three feasts represent three very important elements. Christ's death, Passover, his resurrection, the Pentecost, and then, of course, our future hope of gathering of the saints, the rapture for heaven, being the Feast of Tabernacles. And by the way, we're right in the middle of that season of the Feast of Tabernacles right now. King Solomon also built a fleet of ships in Ezion-Geber, which is near Elath on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. You know, I'm an old Navy man. I spent 4 years in the Navy. I took note of this. This is the only place in the Bible that Israel is shown to have built a navy. You know, they were an inland country. They didn't have a seashore. But they did have the Sea of Galilee, but that was fresh water. That didn't count. These guys really got out into the Mediterranean Sea. They used King Hiram, we'll see here in a little bit, to help him build a navy. That's pretty interesting to me. Then Hiram sent his servants with the fleet, seamen who knew the sea, to work with the servants of Solomon. And they went to Ophir and acquired 420 talents of gold from there and brought it to King Solomon. It's interesting that Solomon raised 420 talents of gold during his commerce business of 3 years. That sounds like a lot, and it is a lot. But David raised 100,000 talents in the same period of time by doing war, by conquering people. So you can see war is much more profitable. The gleanings of war, conquering a nation and taking from the nation all of their assets. That's why, folks, I believe a lot of countries engage in war. It is profitable. You look at the Great Depression era before World War II. This country was in tough shape. And how did it come out of it? By engaging in war. Jobs were found. Materials were created. The industrial thing really took off. Kind of a sad commentary, but it is true. Chapter 10, let's get right into it. Now when the king of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. Now we get into an introduction of a new character. Her name is the Queen of Sheba, a woman. The land of Sheba was southwest area of Arabia, which was about 1,500 miles from Jerusalem. That's a long, long ways on a camel. Actually, calculated out about 75 days of traveling on a camel. This lady must have really, really wanted to check old Solomon out, because 75 days on a camel in the desert for this lady was quite the feat. But Solomon had really gained a reputation. She had heard of a temple where man could approach God. That was unheard of. A temple built for a man to be able to come into the sanctuary of God, where God dwelt. That drew her curiosity. She wanted to know about that. And she'd also heard that Solomon had great wisdom. And she was a lady that was well accomplished. She was a very wise woman. And she was drawn to that sort of thing. Verse 2, she came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels that bore spices, very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. So Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing so difficult for the king that he could not explain it to her. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his servants, the service of his waiters and their apparel, his cupbearers and his entryway by which he went to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. Then she said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. However, I did not believe the words until I came and saw with my own eyes, and indeed the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity exceeded the fame of which I heard. Happy are your men, and happy are these servants who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel, because the Lord has loved Israel forever. Therefore, he made you king to do justice and righteousness." You know, this king was the head of a very civilized country herself. And she was very interested in Solomon because of all that he had accomplished. We're sort of drawn that way to people that are successful, aren't we? We look to them and we see, wow, what did they do to get to where they are? And we start evaluating if we can do that. What would it take for me to excel and exceed like him? She may have been mulling over in her mind. But it was not his riches or his well-trained servants or the great tables of food that drew her most of all. It was the wisdom that God had given him. The wisdom that God had given Solomon. She was a wise woman, and she respected that wisdom. I think of the wisdom that Solomon got because of the prayer that he prayed. "Lord, would you give me that wisdom from on high so that I can run this country? Because I'm going to need it." He could have, as the Lord said, "You could have asked me for great victories over your enemies or great riches." But he didn't. He asked for wisdom to manage the people, to rule over the people. I love that. Verse 10, "Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold, spices in great quantity, and precious stones. There never again came such abundance of spices as the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Also the ships of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought great quantities of almug, wood, and precious stones from Ophir. And the king made steps of the almug wood for the house of the Lord and for the king's house. Also harps and stringed instruments for singers. There never again came such almug wood, nor has the like been seen to this day." So King Solomon gave the queen of Sheba all she desired, whatever she asked, besides what Solomon had given her, according to the royal generosity. So she turned and went to her own country, she and her servants. You know, in Matthew 5:16, Jesus says, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." You see, at this point, Solomon, at least in his life at that point, I want to make clear, he was doing right by God. Up until this point, he was righteous before God. He was doing the right things. He was giving God the glory. And he was shining forth his light before men and women, before the entire world. Now, Israel was at its height of glory at that time, as I've said earlier. And all of the world, the known world at that time, was looking upon them. When people see in your life steadfastness, joy, peace, they say, "Well, what does she or he have going on? What are they doing that I don't have in my life?" They evaluate themselves that way. They evaluate you that way. You don't even know you're witnessing many times. But yet you are. We are creatures of habit. We, you know, it's kind of funny. We see somebody doing something and we do it. It's sad to say that Christianity today has gotten kind of a bad rap. It's almost gotten a reputation for being a mouthpiece of God instead of an example. You see, people hear us saying don't do this and don't do that, all negative. But yet if we experience the good, we show the goodness of God in our lives, the joy, then there will be an effect on those around us. You know, also there's another, just a few verses down in Matthew 12, 42, Jesus says, the queen, now listen, this is an interesting verse. The queen of the south will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed a greater than Solomon is here. Now, none of the commentaries but one even mentioned this verse. But to me, it seems like a direct tie. That was the woman that we're reading about here in 1 Kings chapter 10, Queen of Sheba, the Queen of the South. And if she rise up in the judgment, the reason Jesus, I'll remind you, that he said this statement was he was saying to the Pharisees, listen, you guys, if you were just have been as much as this Gentile woman, the Queen of Sheba, she believed by faith. She took on what Solomon had and that God had blessed him, and she didn't question it. Here I am. Jesus went on to say, I am greater than a Solomon, and you're questioning who I am and the truth of what I say. I find that interesting. Does this mean that she was saved? No, not. I can't really say that. But at the same time, it looks pretty favorably onto that too. She received the truth spoken by Solomon, and it was better than what the Pharisees' religion that they proposed by far. The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. Besides that, from the traveling merchants, from the income of the traders, from all the kings of Arabia, and from the governors of the country. Here's another thing that's interesting to me. Maybe it was just my mind this week. No one else I even read commented about this, but that number jumps out at me. 666. Why that number in the Old Testament? By the way, that number, for those of you who don't know, is a number of the... That's right. The Antichrist is going to give you that number, give a person that, not you, but those people that reject the Lord or those people that aren't Christian that are here on the time of tribulation, the time that they have to go to buy and sell. They'll have to have a mark in order to buy and sell goods. 666. Now, that amount is equivalent, that many talents is equivalent to $1 billion in money today. $1 billion. Now, how do we wrap our mind around $1 billion? Because I certainly can't. I had to break it down this way. Guys, if you gave your wives $1,000 every day to go shop with, okay, and she went away and you counted how long she was gone to spend away $1 billion, if she spent at a rate of $1,000 a day, you wouldn't see your wife for 3,000 years. In other words, you'd never see her again. That was a lot of money. And King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold in verse 16. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 shields of hammered gold, 3 minas of gold went into each shield. The king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Solomon had so much gold that he started making armor, body armor, out of it and making stuff for his summer house, making gold articles, little gold knickknacks. Moreover, verse 18, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had six steps, and the top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the place of the seat. Two lions stood beside the armrests. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the six steps. Nothing like this had been made for any other kingdom. He had so much gold that he took gold and covered a very expensive ivory. You know, ivory, which comes from the tusks of the elephant, was extremely rare and hard to get, you know, with a chariot and a spear and a sword. How do you chase down an elephant? You know, it had to have been pretty rare. And then they took this ivory, made this throne, and they overlaid it with gold. That was how plentiful it was. I find it pretty amazing. The abundance was coming. Why? Because of God's blessings. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. For the king had merchant ships at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the merchant ships came bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and monkeys. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. You know, this section is reported and recorded here by the author, and I believe it's here so that we will see such indulgence that one cannot read without thinking, wow. I believe that he went out of his way, the author, to draw us in as studiers of the Word, the amount of glory that was being poured out, blessings that was being poured out, and how important we will look back and see that it was not handled properly. It was used for luxury. This blessing from God was because of his wisdom. God gave him wisdom to conduct commerce and business. And David had conquered all his enemies all around. And so they really were at a great time. But it was mostly because God was pouring his blessings out upon them. Let's finish this up. Now all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Each man brought his presents, articles of silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, and mules at a set rate year by year. And Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and he made cedar trees as abundant as the sycamores which are in the lowland. Also, Solomon had horses imported from Egypt and Kivi. I said that real fast because I'm not sure how to pronounce it. The king's merchants brought them in Kavi at the current price. Now a chariot that was imported from Egypt cost 600 shekels of silver, and a horse 150. Thus, through their agents, they exported them all to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. You know, in Deuteronomy 17:16, the Lord specified, and we've talked about this before, not really, it was to all the kings of Israel, not to multiply to himself horses, gold, and one other thing, wives, women. Is this because the Lord is conservative? Is it because the Lord is on the Republican side? No. It's because he knows the tendency of our heart, that we'll trust in horses and that we'll rely on gold rather than seek him every step of the way. Bottom line, when we get rich, we don't know how to handle it. And I have often prayed, Lord, I don't want to be rich. Just give me enough. But only God knows what's enough. He knows every situation. He knows every motive of each man and woman here. And he has a plan that fits perfectly for you. Next chapter, in chapter 11, we are going to see why the author poured out such an emphasis on overindulgence, because Solomon will fall to it. And it will cause him to lose a heart for the Lord that his father had.